Okay, this evening we're going to be looking at directions for duty. You might turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And we're going to look at verses 13 and 14. These passages read, this is the New King James Version, "Watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. Let all that you do be done with love." As we all know, the first century is the setting for the New Testament, and it was a time when Rome ruled the whole world. But all across the empire, as spread out as it was, there were visible reminders of the might of Rome, and that was due to the presence of military forces in different places. Even in Jerusalem, there were Roman soldiers seen often enough to be considered commonplace. So we can understand how Paul might use military terminology in some illustrations of his points that he was making. And he's using some of this terminology in the text here in verses 13 and 14. Brother Mike Willis, in his commentary on 1 Corinthians, suggests that verse 13 is like orders from a military leader, in the fact that there are very short and so on, they're to the point. And that may be so, that it's kind of an imitation of that. But the orders are tempered by the words then of verse 14, "Let all you do be done with love." So let's take a look at these things and consider some of the things that we find here. The first one is that we are to watch. Now, the idea of watch, or a watchman, or someone performing the duties of a watchman, there's always been a need for God's people to be on guard. And to be on guard, if you will, to watch for physical enemies. And that was pretty well the case on a number of times back in the Old Testament. One instance is in Nehemiah chapter 4 and verse 9. "Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God, and because of them," that's those that were conspiring against them, "we set a watch against them day and night." So they were watching for physical enemies. It got to the point to where when they were working on the wall, one man would have, for example, perhaps tools in one hand and a spear in the other. So they were on watch. They were always diligent about this. Now, another case in the Old Testament is in Deuteronomy chapter 12. And by the way, we're only going to look at these two, but that doesn't mean it's the only two. But Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 29 and 30. "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourselves that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, 'How did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise.'" And so what he's saying there, you need to be on guard for, just to watch that you don't enter into idolatry. That's his point. Now, we know later on, sadly to say, that when Israel did go in and take the land, they didn't drive all the people out. And as a result of not driving all the people out, their idolatry remained with them and remained in Israel, and it plagued them the rest of their time spent in Israel. But even today, watching is something that's important. For example, there's the passage in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 about our adversary, the devil. Walks about seeking whom he can devour. You watch for him, is what he's saying there. And we need to watch from without and from within. Acts chapter 20 is a good example of that. We'll take a look at verses 29 to the first part there of 31. Acts chapter 20, 29 through the first part of 31. I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. Well, that's from without. But now he talks about those within. From among your own selves, men will rise up, speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after themselves. Therefore, watch. And so you watch for those that are from without. You watch those that are from within. And then one more. Jesus, in speaking to his disciples, in Matthew chapter 26, he tells them something there that's very important. I think sometimes this might kind of get left out by many. But Matthew chapter 26 and verse 41, there in the garden, the disciples who said so earnestly that they would never depart from him and they would always, you know, be willing to serve him, they couldn't stay awake. And he says a few things about them. Couldn't you watch with me for an hour in verse 40? And in verse 41, he says, watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. We need to be on watch against temptation. I think sometimes that's maybe not practiced as much, or maybe not practiced as diligently as it should. And the reason I say that is, temptation is something that's generally relative. And by that I mean, there are things that may tempt individuals in this building that may not necessarily tempt everyone. Maybe someone who's tempted to drink alcohol. One person might be, that might be an ongoing thing with them. And yet it's not that way with everybody. It's relative. It might be for one person. But here's the thing. If there was a person and were this posed a temptation to them, then they know that it does. They're aware of it. And so you would think that they would be capable and able to identify this and know where their particular temptations are, and then to make every effort to avoid those things or occasions or places or individuals, whatever it is, where that temptation might present itself. I think that's why we have to look at this. So Jesus is saying, you know, now you watch and pray. You be aware of this. The temptation, and even as much as you might try to avoid temptation, sometimes you're not really looking for it, and sometimes it's not a matter, you know, you're getting too close to it. Sometimes temptation comes looking for you. And so you watch and you pray that you don't enter into temptation. That when the temptations do come, that you don't enter into them. You don't cross over that line, and now it's not a temptation anymore. It has been. It's really tempting me, and I cross the line, and I step right into whatever the action is that tempts me. I think we can get the picture from that. So it's important to watch, as Paul says there in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13. But now he says something else. He says, not only do you need to watch, but you need to stand fast in the faith. Let's consider that for just a moment. I really think what we should see here is that he's saying, you know, you need to have a conviction and follow it. And the truth of the matter is that sometimes there are those that do have conviction. But unfortunately, they may not follow it. And the reason that they don't follow it is because, well, they compromise some way or another. They compromise, they rationalize, whatever it is, and they end up, well, they had that was their conviction, but, you know, they're not really following up on it like they ought to. In 1 Corinthians 15, right before where our text came from, in verse 58, therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. So we need that. We need to be steadfast and immovable, abounding in the work of the Lord, all those things. We need to have a conviction. We need to stick with the conviction. And we need to follow it. And we need to follow the conviction in all settings. The book of Jude. And verse 3. Where it says, "Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once for all delivered to the saints." A lot of times we look at this and we think about the faith that was once delivered for the saints, and we look at that and we emphasize that. That's good. That's fine. No argument there. But you know, he's exhorting them to contend earnestly for that faith. So in other words, you know, that you have the conviction and that you follow after it. Of course, that's what he's saying. Now, it's very easy to see sometimes the overt or public stands. If you consider over here in Acts chapter 17, when Paul got to Athens and what he saw in Athens, a city that was just, well, it says that it's overcome with idols. And really the word there means more than that. The word there really means like when a storm overcomes a ship. You know, it engulfs it. It swamps it. And that's how the city was. It was engulfed and it was swamped with idols. You read anything about Athens and the matter of idolatry, it was just filled with it. This is why Paul says later on that you even had an altar over here to the unknown God just in case you might have missed one. Yeah, they had that many, and they wanted to include all of them, so they had this one over here. Now, he uses that to tell them that there is a God that you have overlooked, actually, and that's the God of heaven, and declares him. And he does this up in the public place, there in Athens, where, well, there are lots of public places. A lot of times there would be conversations and arguments that would take place and discussions different things along this line on any subject in the marketplace. But now this was different. This was, we had been going up this little hill up to a place where people met, not necessarily the common people that would have been in the marketplace and so on, which was, you know, a really big area, but up here. And yes, there would have been philosophers and the more enlightened folks up there and the educated and all that and everything. So he does all of this. Yeah. All over. And it's very, very public. That's easy to see. And he's contending for the faith. He's got a conviction. He's following it. That's what he's doing. Sure. And while we think about that, how about things that are just not quite that dramatic? In Philippians chapter 1, turn over there for just a second. Philippians chapter 1, verse 27. Now, I've got up here what's in the American Standard Version. I've got "only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ." And that, we'll just stop there. That's enough. That's the whole point. In the American Standard Version, it's got "let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ." So that manner of life, that would be day to day. Whatever's going on. And it doesn't have to be overt. It doesn't have to be some public stand. Sometimes it's just the small things. You know, if you think about it this way, sometimes we might impress people, not with just one big burst or explosion or demonstration of our faith, but we might do it kind of like they build a house, a brick at a time. Little thing here, little thing there, so on. And after a long period of time, a person begins to see how this all works with a person on a day-to-day basis. And having this conviction and following it, being steadfast in the faith, I think it's important to understand when he's talking about being steadfast, this is qualified within the faith. Now that's what we're talking about here. People can have a lot of convictions about a number of things. For example, people will stand fast in their political beliefs, won't they? Of course they do. And they will contend for their civil liberties. Yes, they will. People will fight for their favorite ball team or root for them, doesn't matter, or sports team. Doesn't matter, you know. Some will even die for their country. Back in the Revolutionary War period, Patrick Henry of Virginia was known for giving a rousing speech, and at the conclusion of it said, "Give me liberty or give me death." He didn't actually die for the country, but it sounded like his speech he was ready to. But many did, and many have done since. So people will contend for things like that. You know, denominational members will defend their system, won't they? Many of them I've met, talked to, been friends with down to this very day. They'll contend for their system. But then I guess the real question is, who's going to stand for the faith? Will somebody do that? Will somebody, you know, have a conviction and follow it when it comes to our faith? Another point is to be brave. Now, you might find something a little different in some translations, but to be brave in some place, it has "quit you like men" in the old translation. Some newer translation has "act like a man" or "be manly" or something along that line. And I think that something like that is necessary because sometimes we don't act like adults, grown-ups. That's really what the word means there. It's talking about a man as opposed to a child, the word that's used. And what happens is, well, we kind of have a tendency to act like children. In Ephesians chapter 4, verses 13 and 14, "Till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ." Now, you see in verse 13, it would be about being full grown, acting, you know, like an adult. And verse 14, then, "that we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting." And sometimes we act like children in the fact that, well, there's how children are. You know, sometimes children are overly fearful of things when they have no need to. I was watching a commercial on television. I can't remember if it was yesterday or the day before. A little girl goes into her parents' bedroom, wakes up her dad. He asks her what's wrong. And she said, "Oh, you need to come to my room. There's a monster under my bed." Ever have to do something like that? Or perhaps the monster was in the closet. But he's in the room there somewhere. And they're just sure of it. And what do? You go in there. You look in the closet or under the bed. You assure them that there's nothing there. And you try to, you know, calm their fears. They're overly fearful. Children are. On a number of things. And sometimes I think that there are adults that way. Sure, overly fearful. Maybe not of monsters under the bed anymore. But too many times of things when there either is no need for the fear to be there, or it's about something that we can't do a whole lot about. But also, act like children in the fact that we might become alarmists. That everything, you know, is just, it's overblown. It's the Chicken Little syndrome. Some little thing lands on the head and the sky is falling. Alarmist. And sometimes we act like little children in the fact that we are weak. We just aren't what we ought to be, and we need to, you know, become stronger. Sometimes people act like children if they talk the talk, but they are unable to walk the walk. But the contrast in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 13 and 14, if you think about those things, you can see the contrast is from being like a child and instead be like an adult and be brave is what the New King James has. And that would be part of being an adult. The word in the King James Version is "quit." "Quit you like men." And it comes from the other word that means acquit. It would mean how you would conduct yourself. It's only one word in the original language, though in the King James Version it has "quit you like men," but there's only one word, original language, and it literally means, well, act manly, as I've already said. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11, When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I thought as a child, I acted as a child. When I become a man, when I become grown up, I put away childish things. And sometimes we need to do this and to recognize that in making such a change and a move like this, well, there's a little bit of courageousness involved in that as well. Now, one of the things that we've got to do, we've got to be brave, or we've got to be adult enough to act in a certain way in order to, for example, turn the other cheek. Jesus says that's what we need to do. We need to turn the other cheek and not be involved in retaliation. But it's kind of take the loss, understand this, and kind of move on. We also, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 25, it says, therefore, putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Well, we need to tell the truth. And sometimes that might not always be the easy thing to do, to tell the truth. You know, here's something to think about. The right thing. Well, telling the truth is the right thing. Of course it is. It's the right thing. But the right thing, no matter if it's telling the truth or any number of other things, the right thing is seldom easy. It may be a little bit hard or a little bit difficult. Well, yeah. And that would be good for us. It's good for us sometimes to do some things that are difficult, that are not easy. I've always found that in all of the things I've tried to do, it didn't matter what it was. If it was at work, if I was working on the production line, then later on in maintenance, whatever it was, you start preaching, you're trying to do this, that, and the other. And there's a lot of times when you find out that a certain thing is hard to do. Now, here's what happens. If you run into something and it's hard to do, and maybe you fail at this or you're not as successful as you think that you ought to be, and then you just decide, well, I'm not going to try that again. When will you be the master of that? Well, probably never if that's what you've done. But then a lot of people will run up against something like this, and they'll kind of back up a little bit, and they'll kind of analyze it, and they'll think about what they've done and how they've gone about it. And maybe I could go about it a different way or try some different method or so on. And so they'll have another go at it, and maybe that doesn't work. But you know what? They keep doing this. You keep trying. Because eventually you'll have a success. Thomas Edison, inventor. Not too far from here is where he was born, over at Milan, Ohio. He invented the practical light bulb. He didn't invent the light bulb. Everybody says that, but he didn't. The light bulb existed before Mr. Edison got involved with it. The problem was, the light bulb wouldn't last very long. You'd pour the electricity to it, and the filament would burn up. You had a dead bulb. Now, obviously, the person who could whip that filament thing would just about have the electric bulb business by the tail, so to speak, wouldn't he? So he set about to try different things as filaments. He tried thousands of them before he found the right one. Think about that. And someone asked him one time, well, Mr. Edison, wasn't that thousands of failures? And he said, no. He said, I look at it this way. I tried thousands of things and knew that those things would no longer work. And I'll try something else. Until he got it. That's how it works. That's how we ought to be going about this. That we ought to be thinking that, yes, things are difficult, telling the truth sometimes in a situation where somebody might get a little bit upset about it. Or they might, you know, cut you off. You might lose a friend. And or someone might not be as friendly as they were before. But telling the truth sometimes is something that needs to be done. And we need to be brave in order to do that. In James chapter 4 and verse 4, how about this? Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. You think about how that would be to be brave in order to speak against worldliness. Speak against that in a time, and our time's no different than any time before us, in which there are a host of people who run after worldliness. And to speak against it, well, that goes against the grain of popular thought and popular practice, yes. But if you're brave, you'll speak out against that, like James did here. And then also, and I think this is sometimes a difficult thing, to correct a loved one. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, and verse 7, let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in word and doctrine. Now, they're going to have to do certain things, and corrections are going to have to be made. And when we think about this, and correction being, I don't think that's the right passage. I think it's verse 7 up there. I'm sorry. These things command that they be blameless. And that is, you know, correcting a loved one. But that's not always an easy thing, to correct a loved one. A lot of times we would like to give our loved ones a pass. You know, in family settings, that's what happens a lot. You give a loved one a pass. And it might be easy if someone's not a family member to offer correction to them. But when it comes to a loved one, sometimes we just have a tendency to not want to do that. But if it's a loved one that needs correction, we need to be brave and we need to do that. Another thing he mentions there is to be strong. Well, we can be strong. Now, if the idea is consistent that he's talking about, you know, military commands and other things, I would remind everybody about the armor of God in Ephesians chapter 6, starting at verse 10 and continuing. There he says, we're given everything that's necessary to fight the good fight of faith. And we're to be strong in this. Be strong in the faith. I think he says it a couple of times in the context there in Ephesians chapter 6. And it is a strong faith that ultimately brings the victory. In 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4, whatever is born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. And I'd qualify that by saying, well, that takes a strong faith that's going to bring victory. Not just any faith will do that. And even in the Scriptures, we find out that there are different kinds of faith. There's strong faith. There's great faith. Jesus talks about, why have I found so great a faith in all of Israel? And he talks about a Gentile. And then he speaks to his disciples on another occasion and calls and says that they have little faith. And sometimes even, O ye of little faith or weak faith. So there's different kinds of faith, as it's described, different measures of it. But strong faith is what will bring the victory. And then all of these things are to be done with love. This is included, I think, verse 14, that tempers the other remarks that you find in verse 13. And so there must never be the attempt to domineer. We must always be striving to be the right kind of servant. Now, not only the one that we might be working with, but ourselves as well. It's a two-way street. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24, a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient. And so we need to be the right kind of servant, seeking to do that. That's supposed to be done with love. And there, it's also, you know, it's when we talk about this, we have to realize we're not talking about the love that might be out in the world. We're actually talking about the love that's found in the Bible, Bible love. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 13, we know this, that it's the most abiding thing. And it's not necessarily, you know, emotional love that you might think about, or I think what's popular. I think many people look at this over in 1 Corinthians 13. They think that's what it is over there. I'm sure there was a time when I thought that myself. But when you get into the definitions here, in verses 4 through 7, you find out it's not necessarily emotional love. It might be a factor, sure, but it's not necessarily the only thing. Love suffers long, is kind, it does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. When you think about that kind of love there, that kind of love can be very strong. It's going to take a strong person. It's going to take a grown-up person, someone acting like an adult, to be able to do all this. But now, if it's just emotional love, and even though emotional love could be very strong, emotional love is generally temporary. It will rise up and it will be extremely strong and then it can fade away. But now the love that you read about in the Bible abides. Abides before everything else. Remember down there in verse 13, now abide in faith, hope, and love, these three, but the greatest of all of these is love. It abides. It stays. It's not temporary. And so we need to have a sense here of certain things when we do these, when we practice the things that are there, the orders that are there. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 22. Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart. So there's a constancy involved where this is continual, that you continue to do this. So it's the Word of God which lives and abides forever, and our love ought to live and abide with us as long as we are around. Certainly the love of God will abide with us forever, not just in this life, but beyond. And while we're here, we ought to be practicing it with a certain constancy. We also can think about our duty in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 3, the sense of duty. This is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome. Well, there ought to be a sense of duty. I think a sense of duty in a lot of things anymore in life are lacking. And certainly when we come to religious matters, there ought to be a sense of duty involved. And then finally, Galatians chapter 5 and verse 13, where it talks about service. For you, brethren, have been called to liberty, only do not use your liberty as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love, serve one another. Now, those who are Christians, turn in your Bibles to the song that's been selected. Those who are Christians need to follow these directions. That's who they're given for here. But then those who are not Christians don't really need to be worried about these things right now. Those who are not Christians need to worry, first of all, be concerned about becoming a child of God by believing in Jesus Christ, repenting of sins, and being baptized. The opportunity is yours tonight to do those things. We'd be happy to assist you in that. If you are a child of God, then we encourage you to follow the instructions that are given in the Bible, not only in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 13 and 14, but in all things. So that indeed we can be the kind of individual that God would have us to be. If you're subject and we can help you, please come while together we stand and sing.